Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Before spoken language, babies engage in the language of physical contact. Researchers say that our sense of touch, in fact, is a powerful tool that affects every aspect of our lives: cognitive, emotional, developmental, and behavioral. Neuroscientist David Linden explains the power of touch and how it contributes to our general health in his new book entitled Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Dr. Linden is a professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
You begin the book with a kind of would you rather question, something like if you had to lose one of your senses, which one would you rather lose? Which I think is interesting because I don't think a lot of people think of even touch as a sense, amazingly.
Well, I think it's easy to do that. And actually, the situation is if you could only retain one sense, which one would you keep? Which is slightly different. And people don't tend to choose touch. And I think the reason is this. If you're sighted, you can close your eyes and imagine being blind, and you can plug your ears and imagine being deaf. But there's no way to turn off your touch sense. And so, as a consequence, it fades into the background, and we don't imagine its loss.
Yeah, I refer to it as sort of the first language, the language of touch. Was that accurate?
In many ways, it is, because the touch sense develops fairly early in utero and is, of course, fully functional at birth.
And we're talking about touch, but when I say something feels good, I'm not necessarily meaning I touched it and it feels good. So there's a language issue there, too. It's interesting.
Well, right. Why are our feelings called feelings and not sightings or smellings? I mean, this may sound like a silly quirk, and you may wonder, well, does this just really tell us anything about being human, or is this just a quirk of English? But it turns out that my feelings, to mean my tender emotions, is a construction that you actually find in many different languages all around the world, and not just Indo-European languages. And I think it speaks to something crucial, and that is the sense of touch is intrinsically emotional, and interpersonal touch is crucial social glue. It's what tells you, you can trust me. We're on the same side. It builds bonds. It turns sexual partners into lasting couples, and it unites families, and it builds teams, both in the workplace and literal teams in the world of sports. Touch is social glue for humans.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the sense of touch. My guest is Dr. David Linden, from Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His new book is entitled Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Studies have shown relationships between touch and immune systems. How does touching affect our physical health?
Well, it really affects our physical health most in very, very early life. It has effects all throughout life. And I apologize for the ambulance going by outside my window.
Happens, don't worry.
What we know is that you can be born blind and you can grow up just fine. Your brain will be great. Your body will be great. Same, you can be born deaf, have rich and fulfilling life. However, if you're born with a sense of touch intact, but you are touch-deprived as a baby and toddler, and we know this because this happened in understaffed orphanages in Romania in the 1980s and 90s, that a complete disaster unfolds. These children develop repetitive, self-soothing, rocking motions. They have problems with emotional attachment, cognitive problems, with depression. And the problems aren't just psychiatric. It turns out that your growth is stunted, the development of your immune system and your digestive system is impaired. So unlike other senses, touch is not optional for early human development.
Do we know why that is?
We really don't. In other words, I would love to be able to say to you, well, when a baby is touched, the signals go to the brain and it produces this cascade of biochemical signals that then impact the immune system and the digestive system and these other things in this way. But we don't understand that.
How What does the relation? What do we know about the relationship between how the brain operates and pain, just touch in general?
Well, I think the most important thing to realize is that we think of touch as one unified sense, but it's actually many, many different streams of information all coming together in our brain. So if you look in the skin, there are separate sensors for heat and cold and pain and sexual sensation and texture and pressure and so on. All of this information flows to our brain and gets blended together into what we call touch. But within that, it goes to two different places in the brain. One place, called the somatosensory cortex, is all about the facts of touch. Where on my body am I being touched? How strongly am I being touched? And what's the nature of that touch? And the other part of the brain, called the posterior insula, is a region that imbues touch with its emotional significance. So that what makes a wanted caress feel good. That's what makes sexual sensation feel good. And that's what makes pain feel bad.
Is there a difference, and if so, what is it, between men and women when it comes to touch?
Well, there are all kinds of socially constructed differences, but biologically, there's a very interesting one. So if you take 1,000 women and 1,000 men and bring them in the lab and ask, how good is their finest touch discrimination on the fingertips? And, of course, the fingertips are a very sensitive place. What you find is that, on average, the women do a little better than the men. And you might think, well, why is that? Is the skin of the women a little softer and more easily indented, and that's why they can have this finer sensation? No, that's not the case. Is there something different about the activity of the factual touch centers in the brain in women? No, it doesn't seem to be the case. It's actually really simple. Women, on average, have smaller fingertips than men. And you have a certain number of fine touch sensors on your fingertip. And if your fingertip is smaller, then they're packed closer together with smaller gaps in between them. And so your fine touch sense is a little better. So women with unusually big fingers have slightly poorer touch sensation. Men with slightly smaller fingers than average have slightly better touch sensation. It correlates with men and women, but actually the reason for it isn't anything specifically about being male or female.
And all of our body isn't created equal when it comes to touch. That's why some people can tickle you in certain places, that sort of thing. You're more sensitive to certain kinds of touch.
Oh, absolutely. So you probably know that areas like the fingertips and the lips are, you're able to discriminate very fine kinds of touch. In places like the small of the back, you can't. And this is because the finest touch sensation, like you would need to read Braille dots, for example, requires a particular kind of nerve ending called a Merkel ending. And there are lots of Merkel endings in your fingertips and in your lips and your tongue, which is why you can read Braille dots with all of those locations. But you might think there are other areas of the body that we think of being sensitive. So, for example, the cornea of the eye is sensitive. The genitals are sensitive. But they are sensitive in the sense that they can detect very tiny deflections of the skin, but they're not discriminative. They can't tell fine form. So if you get a little bit of grit in your eye, for example, it may hurt like crazy, but knowing precisely where it is in your eye is very difficult. Doctors call this protopathic sensation. So if you tried, for example, to read Braille with your genitals, you would fail. And if your readers want to do an experiment, they can go down to the ATM when no one's around and try this for themselves, too. But I can tell them in advance that it won't work.
Okay. They don't take your word for it.
Yeah.
Please, everybody. So if your nerve endings are damaged in your fingers, they don't repair as easily?
Well, actually, it turns out that peripheral nerve damage, depending on the kind, sometimes it can recover. And it recovers better when you're young, and sometimes it doesn't recover. So neuropathy from viral infection and diabetes oftentimes has very poor recovery. Nerve damage from trauma sometimes can recover and sometimes doesn't, depending on some details. But unfortunately, what happens to all of us in normal aging is that starting at about age 20, we lose about 1% of all of our different kinds of touch sensors In our skin every year. And so gradually, slowly, our touch sense becomes more and more deprived. And this is all kinds of touch sense, from sexual sensation to light touch to pain. And so, for example, one of the reasons why old folks often have devastating falls, there are a number of reasons, but one of them is they have a harder time feeling the ground through the soles of their feet because by the time say you're 70, 80 years old, the number of sensors on the soles of your feet has been drastically reduced.
Is that a function of hormones, the sensors, or is this just your body's just aging and growing old and that's one of the things to go?
That's just one of the things to go. And it goes, it doesn't seem, I'm not aware, for example, of this being accelerated at menopause, for example. Mm-hmm. It seems to happen in both men and women, and it seems to proceed very, very gradually through your whole life, starting at about age 20, about 1% a year. And it has very important medical repercussions. So you may know that, like, a lot of times folks in old age homes, they get these terrible bed sores, and you would think, how can that happen? They look like they would be so painful. Why wouldn't they complain about them? And part of the reason they don't is because they've lost so many of their pain-sensing nerves that they don't notice them because the pain sense is diminished.
It was found that interpersonal touch increased the performances in the national, you know, in the NBA. And what is that about?
Well, I think this points out that touch is social glue. So there was this wonderful study that was done by Dr. Keltner's group at UC Berkeley. And what they did is they took the first half of the season of a year of the NBA playing, and they scored all the games from all the teams, and they scored all the high fives and chest bumps and, you know, fist bumps and pats on the rear end that people do to celebrate scoring.
Uh-huh.
And then they asked the question, does that predict what happens later in the year? And what they found was that the teams that had more celebratory touching not only were more successful and won more games, but they played in a more cooperative fashion.
Wow, that's the NBA, but it makes you wonder how that extrapolates out into any kind of teamwork.
Well, we know that appropriate social touching, and I'm emphasizing appropriate mm-hmm. because there's all kinds of inappropriate touching that can happen, right,
mm-hmm.
is really good in a lot of professional situations. We know that general practitioners who appropriately touch their patients are rated as more caring, that their patients have better medical outcomes on average, and reduced stress hormone levels on average. And you can see this propagated through all kinds of professional situations. Servers in restaurants who give a light touch on the arm tend to give better tips, get better tips.
Mm-hmm. People with a good firm handshake?
Well, you know, a firm handshake is something that's culturally constructed. So in the United States, a firm handshake, particularly from a man, is considered a good thing. There are other places in the world where there are no handshakes or where a firm handshake is considered a really bad idea.
So the pat on the back versus the handshake is not socially constructed. A handshake is something that's part of our social etiquette. A pat on the back is not.
Well, no, these are both things that we construct
okay.
socially. I mean, you can think of cultures where there is very, very little touching, particularly between opposite sex people who are strangers.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of places where you would not shake hands with a colleague or have any casual touching with a colleague. And so there's something biological in the sense that handshaking is occurring with our hands, and our hands are very well endowed with touch sensors. But there is nothing specifically biological about why we shake hands in this part of the world and not in that part of the world.
Yeah. Have you compared how much Americans touch each other compared to other countries?
Well, I haven't particularly, but there's a very famous study that was done by a psychologist named Sidney Girard, and he liked to spy on couples in cafes around the world, not just romantic couples, but friends and coworkers. And in San Juan, Puerto Rico, in the course of an hour, people would have casual touches about 200 times. And in Paris, about 40 times in an hour. And in New York City, about 5 times in an hour. And in London, 0 times in an hour.
Huh.
So there are huge cultural differences about touching.
So much to know about it. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was fun.
My guest has been Dr. David Linden, professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and author of the book Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The World Health Organization has called for an emergency meeting, or last week called for an emergency meeting about how to contain the mosquito-borne Zika virus sweeping across South America. The symptoms of the virus are short-lived and negligible. The greater threat, officials fear, is a possible link between the virus and the roughly 4,000 babies born in Brazil since November with a neurodevelopmental disorder called microcephaly. Joining us by phone is Professor and Head of Biological Sciences at Purdue University, Richard Kuhn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Nice to be here.
You study the Zika virus. Can you begin by defining what it is and where it came from?
So Zika virus is from a large family of viruses called flaviviruses, and we probably are somewhat familiar with at least one member of that group. West Nile virus is the flavivirus. Another member which causes a lot of disease throughout the world is called dengue virus. And Zika and dengue are now co-circulating in Brazil and other South and Central American countries. The virus originally came from Africa. It's been moving around the Pacific, and a couple of years ago was introduced into Brazil. And, you know, we're seeing the outcome of that introduction now.
The virus we know, as I said earlier, mosquito-borne is the most common spread of the virus. Is it any old mosquito, or it could be a mosquito that's in my backyard?
No, it's specific types of mosquitoes, and right now that mosquito is not in your backyard. The mosquito is present in some states in the southern part of the United States, but it's not carrying Zika right now, and it's not carrying dengue virus for the most part in the United States. So it is pretty limited to other parts of the Americas right now, but it is a specific type of mosquito.
I keep hearing and reading that the actual, if you get the Zika virus, you may not even know you have it.
Yes, a lot of, just like West Nile again, mm-hmm. a lot of times, in the case of West Nile, 80% of the times you get infected with the virus, you have no apparent symptoms. And even you might have very mild symptoms that you may just say, I'm not feeling very well. Zika, as well as dengue, if you really come down with a full-blown version, you're going to be a little sicker and you're really going to know you're sick. But it's not going to be, for the most part, it's not going to be life-threatening for adults.
And it doesn't last that long, so identifying who's had it is a problem, too.
That's right. And we don't have great diagnostics right now. Because it's very closely related to dengue virus, in which we do have diagnostics, there's some cross-reading, so it may show up as a dengue virus when, in fact, it might be a Zika. But we should have pretty good diagnostics within a few months that will really clearly discriminate between these viruses.
There's news from Texas that it can be spread through sexual contact. What do we know about that?
Yeah, that's pretty new because the other flaviviruses, from what we know, are not spread in such a manner. So again, just like the transplacental transmission of the mm-hmm. virus of Zika, this seems to be a little bit different than what we've seen for the other flaviviruses. And I should say, we have lots of experience with flaviviruses. Besides West Nile, which entered the United States in 1999, yellow fever, we've had a vaccine against yellow fever for about 80 years, a very, very effective vaccine for yellow fever. And so as a world population, we have a lot of understanding of these flaviviruses, but Zika seems to be one that has now emerged for whatever reason and is really different than some of these other flavies.
Okay, it's different than the other flavies. Does our experience with those flaviviruses, though, is it encouraging in terms of either finding a better way to screen for it and or a vaccine?
Yes. So, you know, I already said that the diagnostics are actually you know, we get cross-reactivity with the dengue virus. So we'll be able very shortly to discriminate between the dengue and Zika. Mm-hmm. Dengue virus, it turns out that there's a vaccine that was just licensed in Mexico in December and being licensed in a number of other countries. There are a whole bunch of manufacturers that are producing different types of dengue vaccines. And so Zika hopefully will be a little bit easier than dengue in terms of putting together a vaccine.
Yeah, when the World Health Organization declares it a global health emergency, does that change the dynamics of getting a vaccine approved in the United States?
Well, you still have to go through, all of the safety protocols. I think the NIH and particularly the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease is really putting a full court press right now, putting all its internal resources as well as collecting scientists from around the world, putting additional resources to get diagnostics, to get vaccines, to get antivirals developed and, of course, then marketed. So I think there's a big push. I don't think we're going to go and jump in without proper testing, because the last thing we want would be something that would make the disease perhaps worse.
What about travel to countries where it is known to be spreading? What is your advice to people?
So for most people, take the appropriate precautions. Actually, for all people, take the appropriate precautions. You know, wear long sleeves. Don't wear shorts. Wear mosquito repellent where appropriate. Stay indoors as much as you can. Pregnant women, on the other hand, or women who could become pregnant, I think there is a great concern. Certainly, as you know, some countries have suggested that women not get pregnant. This is really very unprecedented for health organizations to tell the population, look, be really careful. This is very serious. And so those women who are going to these countries, they have to take absolutely all the protection they can.
Why has the question of microcephaly emerged? When did they make that connection that these babies were being born with these smaller heads and brain damage?
Yeah, well, there was an article actually in the Wall Street Journal just on Saturday that it first emerged. A family of doctors started noticing it in a city, Recife, in Brazil. And so, previously, when this Zika virus was in Africa and in other parts of the Pacific, the microcephaly was not noticed. Now, that may be because there was no microcephaly. It may be that they didn't look. It may be that the number of cases was not concentrated enough for them to kind of pick up on it. These doctors kind of compared notes among their patients, and they noticed that there was a significant uptick in the number of cases of microcephaly. And so they got together and started putting the pieces together, and that's how. So we really don't know. The bottom line is we don't know.
We don't know. Well, I know, Dr. Kuhn, you need to take off. I appreciate your time today so much.
Yeah, great talking with you, Ann.
That's Dr. Richard Kuhn. He's a professor and head of biological sciences at Purdue University. Joining us now is Dr. Margie Rehm. She's a pediatric neurologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk about microcephaly. What is it? Is it that the skull doesn't develop fully or the brain?
Well, microcephaly literally means small brain, small head, and usually the brain, the skull size is determined by the brain size. At least if the brain is small, the skull is also expected to be small. Now, if the skull is too large, that can be because of brain abnormalities or fluid issues. But if the head is small, it's usually because the brain is also too small.
So a lot of us have heard of encephalitis. What is the area? What are we talking about when we see encephalitis or any of those? Is that all brain related?
Yeah. So encephalitis just means an inflammation of the brain.
Okay.
The itis is the inflammation part. So arthritis is a inflammation of the joints, and
okay.
Encephalitis is inflammation of the brain. So that could be because of infection. There's also other inflammatory causes that, like autoimmune conditions, that could cause inflammation in the brain. But if we're talking about babies, encephalitis is usually an infection.
All right. So what did your ears perk up when you started to hear about the connection between, or the possible connection between the Zika virus and microcephaly?
Absolutely. So there's been a few cases of babies and also fetuses that died in utero who were found to have microcephaly. And when those those babies were examined at autopsy, they found evidence of the RNA of Zika virus actually in the brain tissue. So that doesn't mean necessarily that the Zika virus caused the microcephaly, but it does show that there is some co-occurrence at least. And so what we know so far of what's occurred in Brazil is that the cases of Zika virus increased at the same time as the cases of reported microcephaly.
So it's, at this point, a co-occurrence, nothing else.
That's what we can definitely hang our hat on. Now, Brazil has collected a series of women who had babies with microcephaly, and they collected samples from those babies, and they're studying those samples right now. For example, they're looking at the spinal fluid and at viral RNA in the spinal fluid, but those results have not been published.
When you talk about microcephaly, is that then an inflammation that occurs in the brain in utero?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
So microcephaly is just related to the size of the head, and it can be small for a variety of
reasons.
It's
the itis that's the infection part
of it.
That's
correct.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. There's also been a big increase in the number of babies in Brazil born with microcephalus.
That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Anything like that here? Is it a very unusual thing?
Well, microcephaly technically is defined as a head circumference more than 2 standard deviations below the average for a baby's age and gender. So every baby gets their head gets measured. And even during the second trimester routine prenatal ultrasounds, we measure a baby's head size.
Mm-hmm.
So if we expect head circumference to have a normal distribution, meaning it's a typical bell-shaped curve when it's plotted out, then you would expect about 2% of the population to have a head circumference that's 2 or more standard deviations below the mean. So if a baby falls in that range, then that's a trigger to look for various things that could cause the microcephaly.
And is it unusual then? So that's very unusual.
Yes, so less than 2% of the population.
And if you saw a sudden uptick in this, that you immediately start to look for reasons why.
That's right.
Do we know actually what causes it in any kind of situation?
Well,
or is it so rare it's hard to know that?
No, there's quite a few things that we know can cause microcephaly. There can be abnormal brain formation. So there could be prenatal stroke or problems with how the brain cells kind of divide and migrate out to where they're supposed to be in the brain. There can be in utero infections that we know for sure cause microcephaly, like CMV, which is cytomegalovirus. There can be genetic abnormalities and also other toxic exposures that a mother may have, such as alcohol or cocaine or even radiation. There was a big increase in microcephaly in Japan after the nuclear bombs were exploded.
Okay. And do we know why, hypothetically, if something like Zika virus is that the mother contracts, she doesn't have any symptoms necessarily, but she passes it on through to the baby, why such a profound possible impact in a baby where the adult doesn't even know they have it?
The baby's brain is just a very different environment. So the baby's brain is dividing, the cells in the brain are dividing very rapidly. They're maturing and they're taking on specific identities. So very early in gestation, there's cells that are destined to become different types of brain cells. And if there's an insult at that point, then the downstream effect is much greater than if there's already a fully formed brain that then may have an injury in just one area.
And there's no, is this something that you would, you said you can identify it in utero?
So the studies that have been published out of Brazil actually used brain tissue from fetuses that died in utero. You can also identify viruses in amniotic fluid. So that can be obtained from a ongoing pregnancy.
Okay. What do you make of this? What do you have people calling you, telling you whether they should travel to certain countries? What are you thinking about the Zika virus at this point?
Well, we don't have clear evidence that Zika definitely causes microcephaly.
Right.
And in any infection, even if a mother does have an infection, only a certain percentage of pregnant women with an infection will pass that infection on to the baby. And usually there's nothing the mother can do to prevent that. It's just some cases the baby gets it and some cases the baby doesn't. So there's a lot of unknowns in the situation. But what we do know is that there is an increase in Zika and an increase in microcephaly, and the increase is enough to cause concern around the world. So if a pregnant woman or a woman who wanted to become pregnant needed to travel to Brazil, there are certainly precautions that she could take, but I wouldn't take the CDC's warning lightly.
Yeah, right. Right. Are there other things like that that pregnant women need to be concerned about that we don't talk about all this? This is in the news.
Mm-hmm. Zika is in the news, but honestly, there's so many things that we know are under a mother's influence, not necessarily always their control, but certainly things that they have influence over that we know will impact the health of their baby. So general health, avoiding alcohol and other toxins and good nutrition we know are important. And when those things are not taken care of, babies can develop microcephaly. There's also infections that we don't talk about every day, but they're all around us. Like I mentioned earlier, CMV. The majority of the population will eventually get CMV at some point in their life. But if you get it while you're pregnant, there's a big risk to the baby.
Okay, I'm going to take a call now from Abe in Worthington. Abe, you're on the air. Hi, Abe.
Hi, Anne. How you doing? The question is, there was some report out of El Salvador, I think, that there was a Guillain-Barré syndrome associated, cluster associated with this. And the other thing that I think is important is the report of the sexual transmission down in Texas. I'm wondering if there are any comments or if there is anything more on that.
Well, we talked about sexual transmission in Texas a little earlier, but what about the
Guillain-Barré? Yes, so there have been other outbreaks of Zika, like in 2007, where there was an increase in Guillain-Barré syndrome. So Guillain-Barré syndrome is a problem with the nerves, the peripheral nervous system, where there's nerve injury. And that usually causes weakness, and sometimes the weakness can be so profound that someone will need to be on a ventilator until their body recovers. Usually you do recover on your own. There are some things we can do medically to help speed along that recovery. And we see Guillain-Barré after a variety of infections, but it was reported to be increased after another Zika virus outbreak.
So that's another possibility.
Absolutely.
Is Guillain-Barré and microcephaly related in any way?
Well, babies don't get Guillain-Barré. They could potentially be related based on how the virus interacts with nerve cells, but I think we just don't know enough about the virus yet to draw any conclusions. Animal models are... We don't have any really good animal models yet. In fact, if you want a mouse to get a brain infection from Zika, you have to actually inject it into their brain. So I think there's going to be a lot of studies, hopefully, to help us sort this out.
All right. Well, Dr. Margie Rehm, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Margie Rehm is a pediatric neurologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. One in four women have had a migraine at some point or another. As it turns out, these debilitating headaches affect three times more women than men. Now, the authors of a new study say that the migraines heat up as women approach menopause. Joining us now by phone is the lead author of the study, professor and physician at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Vincent Martin. Welcome to the show, Dr. Martin.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
First, can you describe what a migraine is? What's happening when there's a migraine?
Well, migraine is a constellation of symptoms, basically. It's diagnosed by totally by history. So it's not diagnosed by a blood test or by an x-ray. So it's basically a headache that typically is one-sided, is moderate to severe. It can also be associated with nausea, vomiting, and sensitivity to light and noise. In fact, I often tell patients it's almost like being a werewolf. You know, it's like three components to the headache. There's the pain that you have to deal with, but besides that, you also have to deal with the sensory symptoms. So every little noise or bothers you, or light bothers you, and then finally, if that's not bad enough, you get nauseated as well with it. So you don't want to eat or drink during the episode. So there's a variety of different components that make it a very debilitating disorder.
And probably at first, kind of hard to even diagnose in yourself that that's what's happening.
Well, oftentimes people are misdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they're thought to have sinus headaches, for example. But when you take a careful history, these headaches that are thought to be sinus actually have a lot of migraine characteristics. So only about half of all migraine patients are actually diagnosed. A lot of people who also are diagnosed by physicians as having tension-type headaches will have migraines when they're queried more closely about their headache symptomatology.
So what was the objective of this study?
Well, the objective was to see whether headaches actually worsen during the menopausal transition. The menopausal transition is a time period that's defined by both the perimenopause and also the menopausal time period. And frankly, for years, if not decades, women have been telling me their headaches tend to worsen around menopause, but we really had no data to suggest that was actually the case, and we finally do now.
How was the study conducted?
What we did was we mailed questionnaires out to about 3,000 women with migraines. So it was actually about 3,600 women. And we mailed them a questionnaire, and they were actually able to record all the characteristics of their headaches, the frequency of their headaches, and they were also able to give us the details of their menstrual periods and menstrual cycles. So they could tell us whether they were regularly cycling or irregularly cycling and so forth. And from that, we were able then to break the women into three different groups. One group was called a premenopausal group. That's basically a younger group where they have regular menstrual periods. So their menstrual periods occur every 24 to 32 days. And then there was an irregular group where they would have irregular cycles, from month to month. And then there was finally a third group of menopausal group where they had not had any menstrual periods for an entire year. So we're able to break them up into these three groups, and then we looked at the headache frequency in these three groups to determine if the frequency was increased, say, in the perimenopausal and menopausal time periods.
Did you include women of all ages in this study?
We looked at women 35 to 64 years of age, so it was a more middle-aged group, an older group of women.
And did the study's findings align with the previous ideas regarding migraines and menopause?
Yes and no. And we did find that the highest risk time period for what we call high-frequency headache, which was what we call our outcome measure, that's greater than 10 days per month, was during the perimenopausal time period. And even when we tried to put in our models other factors that might modulate headache, like depression and medication use, it didn't really modulate it that much. So it looks like that in the perimenopausal time period, it was probably the hormonal changes that were occurring that were triggering headache. But what was novel was that we also found that the high-frequency headache was increased in the menopausal group. And for years, physicians have been telling their patients, oh, just wait until you get through menopause, your headaches will improve. So what our study suggested was that headaches don't always improve with menopause. In fact, in some patients, they may actually worsen. And what we found was in the perimenopausal group, there was about a 60% increase in the frequency of high-frequency headaches. And in the menopausal group, there was about a 76% increased risk.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the link between migraine headaches and menopause in women. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Many women also experience menstrual migraines. You've written that there are two subtypes of menstrual migraines. What are they?
Well, there's menstrual migraine, basically, and that basically occurs when women have headaches that begin 2 days before the onset of menstrual bleeding with their menstrual period, up to 3 days after its onset. So it's basically a five-day time period. And women have to have these headaches in two out of three menstrual cycles to make the diagnosis. That occurs in about 2/3 of all women. So it's very, very common. And that's thought to be mediated by declining and falling estrogen levels that occur at the time of the menstrual period. And there's a variety of different things that we can do to treat menstrual migraine.
Do men experience migraine headaches differently than women, or is that constellation of symptoms the same for them?
Well, by definition, migraine is defined the same for men and women, but I will tell you that women often have much more disabling attacks. They're much more affected. They often have, they may have more nausea as well as men, than men. So it's just a different presentation. And I think the main reason why men and women differ is because of the fluctuating female hormones that occur with the menstrual cycle in women that are premenopausal.
Personally, I'm more acquainted with sort of the hangover of a migraine. There, you don't feel so badly, except for maybe some oral or, you know, some visual things. But then the next day, you sort of feel like you've been hit by a truck.
Well, migraine is just the pain of migraine is just one part of it.
Right.
There's something called the postdrome and in the prodromal time period. The prodromal time period is before the migraine comes on. People can have a variety of different symptoms like fatigue. They may yawn a lot and so forth. They just don't feel well. And the same thing can happen in the postdrome, which occurs after the headache phase is over. So this whole period of migraine, so the pain may only last for 4 to 6 hours, but you may have symptoms of not feeling well, nauseated. You might feel, you know, like you're just incredibly fatigued, you know, for up to 3 to 5 days around a migraine.
Right. We call it a headache, but it seems to involve so much more of the body than just the head.
Oh, there's just no question about it. A migraine can involve many different organ systems. In fact, there's many diseases that are disorders that are associated with migraine, like depression and anxiety are particularly common in migraine patients. We've published data on asthma. In fact, we just published that about a month and a half ago, suggesting that asthma predicted more frequent headaches. Seizure disorders are more common, strokes more common, heart attacks more common, and there's about 10 other diseases as well. So I think we need to start thinking outside the box that maybe the head pain is just one component of migraine, but it's associated with so many different disorders, even disorders like fibromyalgia.
How does understanding more about the relationship between hormones, menopause, and migraines change or make you reconsider treatment?
Well, I think it's tremendously different. So in the past, all we've done is really treated, you know, the headaches once they kind of come on. We're kind of treating the after result. But if hormones are triggering headache in a large percentage of women, either before or after menopause, then it would make sense to use hormonal therapies that could basically act at the trigger level to treat headaches. And there are certain instances where if women have menstrual migraines, have migraines that worsen around the menstrual period, that giving an oral contraceptive with a very low amount of estrogen might make sense. In some cases, if women go through menopause, and as part of one of their menopausal symptoms, they develop migraine, then in some cases, giving them a small dose of an estrogen replacement in the form of an estrogen patch might make make a lot of sense. But what's really interesting is that in the past, you know, a lot of gynecologists want to maintain estrogen levels very, very low in these women that go through menopause. But just like you wouldn't give one patient one dose of a blood pressure medication or one dose of a cholesterol medication necessarily, mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to adjust it. The same thing is true about hormone replacement therapy in women that go through menopause. So you may start off at the lowest level, but you may need to kind of gradually increase it until you find some improvement. So there's not one level of estrogen in menopausal women that actually prevents headaches. So there's some hormonal therapies that one could try.
What about lifestyle? Are there natural things that you could do? Maybe avoid alcohol? I don't know. I mean, are there things that you can do lifestyle-wise? The American Headache Society, along with other studies, have suggested that an herb butterbur can be used to relieve pain. Can you tell us about what we know about our lifestyles and how that could affect things?
Well, when I see a headache patient in my headache clinic, what I often tell them is they need to follow what we call healthy neurologic lifestyles. And those healthy neurologic lifestyles include a lot of the things that your mother told you when you were much younger. But in the case of a kid who practices these unhealthy neurologic lifestyles, their behavior just becomes completely aberrant and out of control. But in the case of a migraine patient, when they're exposed to these things, they will actually develop a migraine. And the things that we tell people is, you know, you need to get your rest. So if you don't get enough sleep, if you get less than 6 hours or, say, more than 8.5 hours, then you may bring on a headache. You need to wake up about the same time, fall asleep about the same time each day. The migraine brain likes a very regimented lifestyle. You need to keep yourself hydrated. You need to avoid caffeine, although caffeine is a two-edged sword. Sometimes when you have a bad headache, a stiff slug of caffeine can actually help. But if you consume it on a daily basis, it may actually trigger headaches. Other things would be you want to decrease the stress in your life, so not try to overload your schedule. You want to You need to also exercise and keep your weight down. So there's a number of little healthy neurologic lifestyles that may be important for the migraine patient as well.
Is the stress issue, I've heard of people who have migraines who start wearing bite guards and things like that at night because they have bruxisms?
Yes, there's a variety of things that can trigger headache. TMJ, or what we call TMD, which is temporomandibular joint disorder, can be a trigger for migraines as well. And sometimes using a bite guard or some other treatments for that or physical therapy for that disorder can make a big difference in headaches if that's one of your triggers.
When we're talking about migraines and menopausal women or the relationship of migraines to hormones, is hormone issue the trigger, or is it something like a caffeine or lack of rest? How do you define what a trigger is?
A trigger factor is anything that can actually, you know, cause the new onset of a migraine headache. So that could be a hormone, that could be some other lifestyle factor, it could be bright sunlight, it could be weather changes, it could be allergies, it could be a dietary trigger that maybe you have a trigger, like, for example, alcohol can often trigger headache in many people. Other things like MSG, monosodium glutamate, nitrates can also trigger migraine as well.
Yeah, and how common are migraines now? I'm starting to think that they must be pretty common.
Migraines are probably one of the most common disorders that anyone experiences. It occurs in about 12% of the population, or about 16 or 17% of all women and 5% of all men. And in women, for example, when they hit 35 to 40 years of age, up to 25% of all women can have migraines. So I would say there's very few disorders that are this common, and migraine is also one of the most common causes for disability worldwide. It's in the top 10 of disability of all disorders.
And you're saying that it's also underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed. I'm not sure what the right word is.
It's underdiagnosed.
Underdiagnosed.
So only about half of all cases of migraine are actually diagnosed, and there's a variety of reasons for that. One is that a lot of physicians don't receive a lot of training on how to diagnose migraine headache. And then a lot of people may not even present to their doctors. They're treating their headaches with over-the-counter medications, which, if you overuse, may actually cause more frequent headaches. Those are headaches that we call rebound headaches.
And is there over-the-counter medication specifically for migraines now?
There are. There are different anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen and naproxen, and there's also Excedrin Migraine, which has caffeine, Tylenol, and aspirin. And that's been shown in clinical trials to be effective for mild to moderate migraine attacks.
Hmm. Well, as far as the migraine, just once again, can you describe to us what's the difference between a migraine and a regular headache so that people understand what we're talking about?
All right. The two main headaches, the two most common headaches, are one called tension-type headaches and one called migraine. Tension-type headaches are like the exact opposite of migraine, so they tend to be mild to moderate. Migraines tend to be moderate to severe, so they're more intense.
Okay.
Tension-type headaches tend to be two-sided headaches, so they're on both sides of the head. Migraines are one-sided in about two-thirds of patients. Tension-type headache tends to be compressing and tightening, whereas migraine tends to be more throbbing. And then migraine tends to be associated with other symptoms like nausea, vomiting, sensitivity, light, noise, whereas tension-type headache does not. So it basically tends to be a headache that is mild on both sides of your head, and our tension of headache is mild on both sides of your head and more tightening in quality than migraine would be.
Okay. Well, Dr. Vincent Martin, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Dr. Vincent Martin, he's a professor at the University of Cincinnati's College of Medicine. Thanks for listening today. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.